I know a lot of women have suffered, but even today, I look at him and I think there were things I can't go back and get that I could have had when I was with you and didn't get to have those things, but I don't hate you. You know, I don't, you know, you're just who you are. And I was too young to not see that I didn't have to put up with it or anything like that. And so when I look at like Imogen, I really understand a little bit about her relationship because of my relationship because of her relationship. And it's never so simple, I think. Well, no, I shouldn't say never. It's seldom so simple to just say, oh, well, I'm just going to go. I'm just going to leave. If you do that, you know, people don't really act like that. I mean, they put up with a lot or they try and work around a lot. And I would imagine with Roy, I mean, she found herself with three kids in a certain era. What was she going to do? And my understanding is they didn't get along that well for a long time. But as I say in the book, you know, being selfish doesn't make you a bad person. You're just a selfish person. You know, I mean, you're not like a monster. You're just.
Oh, no, he wasn't a monster from what you write in the book. No, but it was just, I was just trying to get at how the autobiography plays into the actual lives and relationships of the artists, the women photographers that you write about.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, like with Imogen, I mean, like with when I read about Roy, I think, how did you even marry this guy to begin with? And then I look at my life, I think, hey, how did you end up living with this guy? You know,
I think that's happened to all of us.
It's kind of a funny thing. You see what they can't see, but yeah, I mean, I don't think I could stand him for 5 minutes. I think it'd be a pretty big challenge.
Exactly. Now, I want to get to another artist in the book, Judy Dater. She was born in 1941, and she's perhaps best known for the photograph Imogen Cunningham and Cuenca at Yosemite, which was taken in 1974. And it happened to be the first adult full frontal nude photograph published in Life magazine. And it shows Imogen Cunningham, very old, almost looking like kind of a Russian babushka, and a very young and naked and beautiful Cuenca Tebow. And they're standing in front of a huge tree, of course, at Yosemite National Park. Now, you write in the book that you actually met both Judy Dater and Cuenca, though on separate occasions.
Yeah.
Can you tell us those stories? Maybe first your run-in with Judy Dater?
Well, I was living at the beach, you know, on Bubble Peninsula in college, and I'd gone down to this gallery, and it was a Judy Dater show. And this was just like a local gallery. It wasn't any kind of big deal. And I saw the picture and I thought, oh my God, I love this. And they gave out this, you know, the free postcard and everything. And of course I was broke because I was in college and working my way through. And so I had it and I put it on the wall. And I just loved it, you know, all the time. I love this picture. And then we ended up moving to San Francisco, John and I. And then I went back to graduate school and then we went back to San Francisco. And so I was at this party at my ex-professor's house up on Russian Hill. And I was in his office and I saw this picture. I said, oh my God, that's a Judy Dater. And it was this great picture. And I said, I love her work. Because by that time I had seen other pictures of hers that I really loved. And he said, oh, well, she's gonna be at this party tonight. Oh my God, I can't believe he's gonna be here. And he was also an author and his wife was a photographer. And it was a very small house they had. It wasn't like this, you know, I mean, you were like up on each other. So I was so nervous she was gonna be there. I was really excited she was gonna be there after all these years. Because it had probably been, I'm trying to think how old I was, maybe like 15 years since I first saw her work in the gallery. And so she comes in, she's with someone else. And my host introduces us. And I said, oh my God, you know, I said, I'm so nervous to meet you and I love your work. And she's like, uh-huh. And then I told her about the picture. I said, well, it was just a postcard. Turns around and walks away. It was like, I'm done with you now.
she went off mingling.
I was like, oh, you're not a paying customer. But yeah, but it was kind of funny. I'm just kind of standing there and I thought, I still love your work. Again, an example of the artist and the art, I thought.
Oh, right. The person versus the artist. Yeah. And Cuenca, you met in 1991 in Portland. Right here.
Yeah, so we had up here. Yeah, and there used to be a gallery. Did you ever know S.K. Josephsberg? It was in the Pearl.
Oh, I've heard the name, yes.
Okay. So he had this great gallery, and he handled photographers. So we were in there, we'd gone to one of the shows that he had put up, and we were buying a picture, and the woman who was helping us, you know, was taking our money and, you know, doing all her thing and everything, very, very nice. And then she said, well, just ask for me, Twinka. Well, it's such an unusual name. And of course, and that made me really see her, because this is decades, right? And I really saw her and I said, oh my God, I can't believe it's you. And yeah, and so she lives here in Portland, and she's my Facebook friend, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I looked her up. She still lives here. She's in her 70s now. I was wondering, besides Facebook, have you ever met up with her again and talk with her?
You know, I only met her at the gallery, and I don't think we met again. I've become friends with Stephen Josephsberg and his wife, Susan Subert, who's also a professional photographer. But no, I mean, I haven't really, no, we're just mostly Facebook friends. But it just seemed weird to me that my life is like Judy Dater, Judy Dater, Judy Dater, all the way up the coast, you know?
In the book's essay on Sally Mann, you write, a work of art always says as much about the viewer as it does about the artist. When I look at that photograph, Imogen and Twink at Yosemite, my eyes are drawn from the much older Imogen and towards the very beautiful young naked Twinka, somewhat as a voyeur, you know, kind of the male gaze. How do you view the photograph as a woman and an artist yourself? And I was wondering how you feel, you know, the fact that a woman took the picture, Judy Dater, how that would differ from if a man had taken the same picture, the kind of effect, the expressions they would have gotten.
You know, it's funny because, as I said, I was so young. I was in college when I first saw the image. I mean, I think your eye is drawn to Twinka more than Imogen, but as you look at it more, you know, you'll start to sort of, you know, drift over to the left. And I remember I had a male friend that was over, not that kind of friend, but anyways, he had seen the picture, and I said, I know, and I said something about Imogen. I said, doesn't she look great? He said, you're not a man, are you? Okay, I got it. And so I don't know, but I think it is voyeuristic. And it did take me until I was a lot older to kind of see the tension between youth and age. And
there's so much in there.
Yeah. And
what a great picture.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I don't know if a man, you know, certainly Judy Dater and her then boyfriend / eventual husband, eventual ex-husband, Jack Wellpott, did that project, Women and Other Visions, where they did photograph the same woman and gave their interpretation of it in the 70s, or early 70s. And I think her pictures are a little bit better, but would I be able to actually tell? I mean, maybe if I really studied them, I would think, well, it looks like a woman took this and a man took this. But once you know who took them, it becomes more evident, I think, you know.
Oh, definitely. And people might react differently if they knew a man took the picture instead of a woman like Judy Dater.
And it is weird. I mean, I know that there's been kind of anecdotal history anyways of male photographers liking very young girls. Or
Edward Weston, a few of those.
There's a few of them in there. Uh-huh. And they, and of course you think, well, yeah, I mean, in a really weird way, taking the body of, say, a 15-year-old girl certainly is a lot easier, I'm guessing, than taking the body of, you know, a 55-year-old woman. You know, I mean, it's not aesthetically, there's something that to me that seems just very easy about, you know, that young, perfect body. So I know that there's, you know, there's some of that that goes on, and I don't think women photographers have that same thing. So I think with women photographers, maybe their view of people is, maybe, I don't know this, maybe it's more expansive in a way. Maybe they look or they find different things, you know, or in the landscape or in objects or something like that. I think it's interesting, Cindy Sherman, she takes herself, you know, but she makes herself different characters.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then on that subject, just a little bit more about Sally Mann. She had a photographic series about her own family, yeah, including her children, called Immediate Family. And you write in the book that this series, and I quote, in a very fundamental sense, defined motherhood for me. And I wonder what you got out of that series, how it defined motherhood for you. What effect did motherhood have on your writing and on your own art?
It made me see that it took the sentimentality out of having kids, which I really liked. And so the kids were beautiful. The situations were not always beautiful, but there was something obviously very art-like about it, but also very sort of real about it. And that really helped me think about being a mother and kids. But the other thing was, she was a mother who was making art while she was home with kids. And that was the other thing that resonated with me, as I thought, oh, you can do this. You
know? Yes, it's possible. it's difficult, but possible, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love those pictures so much. And I know she's got a memoir that came out several years ago, but I never read it until after I finished this book, because I wanted just what I already knew of Sally Mann from a long time ago, you know, how I felt about her then. I didn't want it colored by anything, you know, after that, really.
All these stories are just amazing. And again, I haven't heard of many of the artists in the book, or just very briefly. But I want to talk a little bit about Ruth Orkin. Such a full, productive, and fascinating life. She was 18 in 1939, and apparently she bicycled across the country on her own from where she lived in Los Angeles to the New York World's Fair. She worked in advertising in the 60s, the Mad Men era, and you have some parallels to your mother's career. She took a series of photographs when she was living in New York, a 15-floor apartment on Central Park West, and that series was called A World Through My Window. And she also did photo portraits of some famous celebrities, Einstein, Hitchcock, even Woody Allen, who we were talking about. How do you see yourself reflected in her amazing life, especially how she balanced all these experiences and adventures with motherhood, kind of like you were talking about, you could be a mother and make art at the same time?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Ruth Orkin, and this is her in September, I think her birthday is like September 3rd, but this is, she would be 100 years old if she was alive today, her centennial. And she did incredible street photography too. I mean, people start thinking now more about Vivian Maier, but she was sort of the pre-Vivian Maier in a way, although, I mean, some of what they did was kind of overlapped, but she's a little earlier. I think with her, again, it was the idea that you could be home. I mean, she was kind of clear, like, I am stuck at home. It wasn't like she said, oh, you know what? Can't wait to be home and can't wait to be in this apartment. And yet she made art out of it. And I think it's a kind of a lesson of, you know, you can make art out of almost anything, but you do have to have the skill for it. I mean, I'm talking about like a DIY kind of thing. And she had made a movie with her husband and this other man, which got nominated for an Oscar, and that Francois Truffaut said kicked off French New Wave.
Wow.
It's a terrific movie. And then the second one, which is my favorite one, she was only a screenwriter because by then she had had a child. And then the third one, it was a trilogy and she didn't have anything to do with it at all. And the third one is my least favorite. I mean, even before I knew she didn't have anything to do with it. And she had her first child, I think, when she was 39. So she had two kids like at 39 and 41. Lee Miller had her first child at 40. I mean, sometimes, you know, even with Imogen Cunningham, she didn't get married until she was 29. And for her era, that's a little bit on the late
side. Yes.
So a lot of these women too have these lives. I mean, Imogen Cunningham had kind of an amazing life for where she came from. Certainly Lee Miller did. You know, so did Ruth Orkin. I mean, Ruth Orkin, she was also a ship's photographer. She did some work in Israel for a while. She was coming back through Europe when she took the really famous picture of Jinx Allen walking down the street in Florence. So that was the other thing that was interesting to me too, is that these women had these lives and then moved into this sort of domestic sphere. And that was kind of resonated with me as well, because I didn't have my son until I was 36. So, and then suddenly you're home. And so I think that really related for me. And also what related for me too was in terms of Imogen Cunningham, who said, hey, I took pictures of plants because that's where I was. I was going to And Ruth Orkin says, yeah, I took pictures out the window because that's where I was, you know. And so with those women too, it was really nice to see that, you know, they were still making art, but also they weren't saying, oh my God, this was such a great opportunity. Who knew I would take these beautiful botanicals because I was stuck at home with three kids. And, you know, it didn't have that kind of, none of them had that kind of vibe about them. Like, oh, whatever you thought was bad turned out to be great. You know, they were like, yeah, I was home with the kids. And so, you know, so what the hell? And they ended up making doing some great stuff, all of them.
You're listening to a special edition of Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Whitney Otto, author of the new book, Art for the Ladylike, an autobiography through other lives from Ohio State University Press. We mentioned Lee Miller. You called her the quintessential bad girl, and you kind of contrasted that with another photographer, Tina Modotti, who died tragically fairly young, about the age of 46. And you called her the good girl, which is not necessarily a good thing from what you said. Can you tell us a little bit to contrast Tina Modotti and Lee Miller, why one's the good girl, one's the bad girl?
Well, I think I used both of those, you know, terms pretty loosely. And I think the main difference between them, for me, it seemed like Tina Modotti comes across to us as someone who, I mean, she's very politically involved, but a semi-life of service in a sense, and, you know, in principle, and just, you know, and like she said at one point in this parlor game, Tina Modotti profession men, you know, she had, you know, various men that she was involved with who generally were in politics, not Edward Weston, certainly. But I think she was someone who said, okay, I'll do this. I'll you know, come to my house, I'll feed you. Come to my house, I'll entertain you. You know, I'll model for you. I'll work in your, you know, gallery. You know, I'll do all these different things. Whereas Lee Miller always strikes me as someone who says, I'm not doing that. I'm doing that. Somebody else. And so I think that's why they, and yet they twin for me in that they both have some real similarities in their lives, and they were both considered great beauties. They both were the muses and assistants and students of very famous, very successful male photographers. They traveled out of their homes to other countries. They're very desirable. They fall apart, though, both of them, really in their 30s. You know, they really, nothing goes the whole distance with them, in a sense.
Yeah, Lee Miller lived a much longer life, but she did have that decline. And you mentioned, yeah, very beautiful as a young woman. She was painted by Picasso, filmed by Cocteau, photographed by Man Ray. But she did happen to also buck a catch-22 about women photographers, which you repeat several times throughout the book. The quote is, they tell you that the important pictures are taken on the battlefield, then ban you from the battlefield. So it's a no-win situation for a woman. They weren't allowed to be combat photographers during World War II, but Lee Miller kind of stumbled into it. Can you tell us how that happened, how she ended up taking pictures of a battle between the Germans and the Allies in France?
She was living over in London with yet another man. She was married to this Egyptian businessman, but they didn't live together. He was in Egypt, and she was living with this British man. And the war begins. Her parents wanted her to come back to the States. She didn't want to go. She stayed, and she was sort of filming. She was working for British Vogue, which is called Brogue. She's filming different things that are happening around, like land girls or people in the tube or things like that, because they certainly weren't going to send her over to be a combat photographer. Well, anyways, finally, she gets the opportunity to go over to the continent. She has her own uniforms made. I think they're really beautiful, too. And she hops on a troop flight or whatever it is, and she goes over there, and she ends up at St. Malo. And I guess there was this, I don't know, whatever you call them, a group of German soldiers who, they didn't know the war was over, basically.
It was August 1944.
Yeah, and so they're still fighting. And so she took pictures, and she said, you know, I became a combat photographer. Like, you know, she wanted to be one before, but she just couldn't be one. And so she ended up being one anyways.
And she also had some very fortunate timing a few months before that, and it resulted in a famous photograph. I wonder if you could tell us how she ended up getting her photo taken in Hitler's bathtub in Munich, just about the same time Hitler was committing suicide in a bunker in Berlin.
Yeah, so she's living in London, you know, with this man. And then there's also this young American, he was like a photojournalist named David Sherman. He's staying with them. And she, by this time, I want to say she's in her early 30s, maybe, or 30, 31, 32, whatever she is. And he's in his 20s. And they end up traveling together when they go over to the continent. And they are sort of semi-attached to, I don't know if you call them battalions, I don't know what you call them, regiment, I don't know, of American soldiers. And they're sort of following them around. And David Sherman is taking pictures. She's taking pictures too, but she's also writing these dispatches that she sends to Brogue. And that's how she ends up at Dachau. And that's how she ends up photographing burned out towns, women who are French collaborators. I mean, all these things. And then she kind of goes into Paris every once in a while and meets old friends and kind of goes back out again. And so one of their travels, they end up and they talk their way into Hitler's apartment. And so they're down there in Hitler's apartment. And the thing I love about it, I didn't write all about this. I mean, I wrote about it a little bit, but I didn't do the whole thing she said about the apartment. But basically she was saying the art was really it was very mediocre, and it looked like a rental that could be cleaned out in 5 minutes. I mean, it's like, it was so great the way she describes the apartment, but yeah, that sounds like Hitler. I mean, it's exactly like him. Like, you don't love anything, you don't give a shit about anything, you know?
Right, got a great sense of interior decoration.
Oh my God, it was so, that was so funny. And so they took some pictures there, and one of them was of her in Hitler's bathtub, where she walked out the dirt of Dachau. And he was, and the phone was still live. He was committing suicide. Oh, they also went to Eva Braun's villa too. She, if you go to the archive, which I haven't been to in England, although I've been invited, there is Nazi souvenirs that she picked up, but they never put them on display. Like if you have to get permission to see them, but she did pick up some things there and stuff that she brought back. And it's one thing that really kind of, I don't know, it was almost like this heartbreaking moment. I don't think I put it in the book though, where she talked about going to these burned out villages. And she said at one point, you know, she was in Germany and they're going through this village and she sees this elderly woman and she's in the street and she's so old and she's trying to pick up something. It's sad. And she said, and I went over to try and help her. And then I stopped and I stepped over her because she always hated everything German, anything related. And that was kind of it for her. When she saw what happened in the war, she just thought, even this elderly woman who's struggling and everything, I'm not doing anything for you.
Yeah, and that was a traumatic experience that kind of followed her the rest of her life and actually caused her kind of almost to withdraw from certainly the art world, from photography.
Yeah, so she, she always remained very angry about the war and everything. And
now, in that same section on Lee Miller, you write, one of the things that interested me about the female photographers in this book is the nature of the relationships with their respective fathers, the elemental, timeless connection that seems outside of age and gender. And Lee Miller had a particularly tragic childhood. You write she was raped at the age of 7. She contracted gonorrhea, which had a lot of complications. But oddly enough, she had generally a supportive and somewhat unusual relationship with her father. And you talk about your relationship with your father in the light of these father-daughter relationships in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting to me that in reading about them and learning about them over the years, I realized all of a sudden at one point, I thought, God, there's not a lot about their mothers or their relationships with their mothers. I mean, they weren't particularly close to any of them, it seemed. I can't speak completely, maybe they were closer than I think, but regardless, their fathers were the ones that were always really influential in their lives. I mean, even with Imogen Cunningham's father, he built her a dark room and he's like, I don't know why I want to be a dirty photographer, but he did it anyways, you know. And then with Mamie Yvonne's father, he said, he set her up in a studio. And Lee Miller's father, after the rape, her parents were very progressive and he said, well, we'll take you into Manhattan. They were living in Poughkeepsie. We'll take you into Manhattan and we'll, you know, take you to a psychiatrist and he's going to have you understand that love and sex are not the same thing, which is why she was sort of notoriously not jealous and very free with her body and didn't care.
Yeah, very open about sex and not possessive at all.
No, not at all. But I think the fathers, and she remained very, very close to her father throughout her life. And, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, conjecture about how close that relationship was, because it was pretty damn close. Yeah. but it's one of those things, again, and I think, and maybe it's the, well, as a person, I'm always sort of endlessly curious about things anyways. But for me, it seems plausible that she could have a relationship with her father that isn't, I don't know, a good idea. that is like too close. You know, I mean, they would travel together, you know, when she was an adult, and I don't know that they had separate rooms. I don't know what happened. And certainly he didn't have a lot of boundaries with her when she was in high school or with her friends. And he, you know, he was unfaithful in his marriage. So it wasn't like he was devoted to her mother in that way. But it seems plausible to me that she could have an intimate relationship with her father and still really love him and still feel close to him and still feel protected by him. I mean, who am I to say that she didn't, you know? And it wouldn't be my relationship with my dad. And I know that generally that's a damaging relationship, but, you know, people are, everyone's a little different, so.
Right, especially artists. but actually it worked out for her no matter what. It seemed like one of the positive aspects of her life, which was, had some tragedies in it, namely that rape at the age of 7.
Yeah. And he was not possessive about her. It was not like he, if they did have some kind of intimate relationship, he still wasn't someone who said, oh, wait, you know, it wasn't like Humbert or something, you know.
or the accident, you mentioned the book Homo Faber, yeah, where a father accidentally has sex with his daughter.
Yeah.
He doesn't know it at the time because they've been out of touch. And so there is, you write a little bit about incest in the book with, yeah, without making any connections directly to Lee Miller's relationship, yeah, with her father, because we don't really know.
Or Nais Nin too. She's another one.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Now you write in
that's
the book.
That's going to be my next book. No.
Oh, is that okay? Because
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, because I actually have kind of a last question here about that. You write in the book that all of your novels can be distilled into three main subjects: women, art, and feminism. And you did a recent live stream event for Broadway Books here in Portland. Mm-hmm. You said you are currently working on a novel, so your next book that you started about 5 years ago, with that theme of art and women, and I would assume feminism too. Is there anything you could tell us about that book, or would you rather not? I know a lot of writers would rather not talk about what they're working on right now. It's almost like a curse.
Well, God, you know, this is the fifth summer since I began it, and it's still not anywhere close to being done. I mean, I have it mapped out, sort of. I mean, it's, I don't really use outlines or anything, but it is kind of in my head. I kind of understand how it should go, how it, you know, how the story should plug into the structure, but who knows? I don't know if it'll ever work out.
But you know, you're back to fiction, it seems, the essays and the nonfiction of Art for the Ladylike.
Well, I like doing the nonfiction because, you know, as you can tell, I'm very chatty and I have a lot of opinions. So, so nonfiction works for me, but it would have to have like a reason. I mean, like more of a structure. It'd be fun to just say, hey, this is what I think about this is what I think about that. But then again, we're in an era where sometimes I think maybe it's better that I'm not publishing anything of what I think.
Well, there's enough people who do all that on social, yeah, media every day. Not worth putting in a book, I think, a lot, yeah, of that stuff. Well, Whitney, I learned so much from the book, and you really shined a light on these great women photographers who are not written and talked about all that much, and yet I think they're great artists, and they led fascinating lives. It was just entertaining and enlightening, and I want to thank you for talking with us about the book today.
Oh my God. Thank you, Ken, so much for having me. Next time, Edward Curtis. No, I'm kidding.
Right. That's a little bit of a private reference where Whitney had an interview where she was talking about women artists, and the interviewer just wanted to talk about a recent book about Edward Curtis, who gets enough press, I think.
Yeah.
So we mentioned him just in passing.
Oh no, but thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with Whitney Otto, author of the new book, Art for the Ladylike, an autobiography through other lives from Ohio State University Press. You can find out more about Whitney, the new book, and all her work on her website, whitneyotto.com. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/between the covers, or just search for it on the KBOO website. KBOO, by the way, is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, thank you for that. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been a special edition of Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Whitney Otto for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.
I have caught the bodies breaking on a barbed wire sea. I have seen desire as he's been.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
The adults have their music, my parents have their music, the teens have their music, but what about me? I said the adults have their music, my parents have their music, but where's my children's music? What about me?